Okay, so the projects are all submitted, I guess. Okay. So I sent the, first of all, I heard somebody saying today is Halloween. So I guess by coming to Brickyard, we have lost touch with reality completely, I guess. So at least if you're in the main campus, you would know probably. It's also another festival of lights called Deepavali, which is celebrated all over India. So they just happen to be approximately on the same day. There are a couple of things that I sent on the mail. Okay, I sent the current cumulatives. I don't know whether you can see it there, but these are the current cumulatives, and I sent some explanations on that. Are there any additional questions on this stuff? Okay, obviously we haven't yet completed project two, so the current cumulatives, these numbers are with respect to just 40 points. And I also mentioned that currently some people wanted to know where they are standing in the class, which is a reasonable question. So I gave some standing, except I'm not really sure how indicative this is of your final standing, because the project one, currently I just took it for 12 points, so which is sort of making, so the way it would work out would be 12 percentage points for each of the three projects plus 4 percentage points for the final demo. That's what I did last time around, so that's what I was going to do. But I did mention to you guys that project one is discounted with respect to the other projects. So if you do well in project two, then essentially if you got less grade, smaller grade in project one, that is not as bad. Okay, because project two sort of includes project one and project three includes project two and one. Okay. But this is, if the semester were to end today, this is where the numbers would stand. Okay. Any questions, comments? Okay. So as far as project, the third part of the project is concerned, we'll put it up quickly. Essentially, you can look at project, I'll send you an email as to when it's officially there in terms of part C. I think there's one there, but I haven't even changed the due date. So basically, you get to do some optional tasks, which, there are some required tasks and then some optional tasks. And in the optional ones, you can decide how to extend your search engine to some extent. And if your search engine wasn't working, by project, the part two, you make it work. Okay, that's your first issue. And then you add more stuff afterward, after it works. So we need to have that thing working. You need to have it at least the minimal one working. Homework would be made due probably in a week time. Okay, that's my current thinking. Okay. Any questions? Okay, so what I'm planning to do today is actually continue the discussion of information extraction. I assume you all read the Noital paper, and I'm going to discuss some of Noital paper as well as a little bit about Semtag and Seeker. So if you haven't read it completely, after this discussion, you can go back and read those papers. Okay. But before I go there, I thought I'll actually mention some things that have been coming up back in the background, and I'll call them big ideas. And these are not things that you can ask questions on the exam for, but these are the big patterns that I see that you would also see if you spend some time on the work in that's going on the web. Okay, so maybe there'll be more big ideas, but these are the ones I wrote up for now. So first thing, of course, is finding the sweet spot in computer-mediated cooperative work. So the idea is, if you have humans in the loop and you're trying to help humans, then So you, the computer solves part, the human solves the rest of it. So it's not at all obvious upfront how much of automation is needed to get the humans to feel as if their life is being improved because of this particular program. Okay, I guess probably this is more of an issue for people who come from artificial intelligence side, AI side, than for some other people. Because in AI, in general, we like to automate the heck out of everything. So, you know, forget about humans. We just automate it, and then they'll give it. You'll give it to them. So it's worth knowing that it's possible to get by with techniques that are kind of blithely ignorant of semantics when you have humans in the loop. So you don't need to know, you, the program, when I say you, the program doesn't need to know anything about semantics. If the humans understand semantics, you can get by with techniques which have no real connection to semantics. And so, for example, the incredible success of the bag of words model, okay, which we all agree is totally nonsensical in terms of capturing any sort of meaning of the page, and yet it seems to do well. Now, the interesting thing, of course, is it's still not obvious as to what is the right sweet spot. Okay, so just to give that, bag of letters would be a disaster model. You know, we talked about this. Okay, bag of sentences would be great, but it's just way too costly. Okay, so I'm sort of looking for patterns, and probably I made one up here, but you know, think about this sort of an issue when you are trying to solve problems which have humans in the loop. Consider the right level at which to automate it. Okay, so that you know, you do part of it and the humans do the rest. So for example, in this case, the computer plays a pre-processing role and sort of presents potential solutions, and we seem to be gratefully taking these and doing more in-depth analysis, which requires actual semantics. Okay, that's one part, that sort of has been the background of the entire first part of the semester. The second big idea, I think, is collaborative computing. And I mentioned this last class, and we talked about it a little bit. It's basically brain cycle stealing. Okay, you know, when some humans are at your website, you have access to their brain cycles. And so just as you want to steal computer cycles, you want to steal brain cycles. And I basically said that it's like the most ideal of the computers, if there's ever one, brain cycle. So if you can somehow steal it and make it be used for doing, make it be useful for doing some more semantic analysis of the data, that's useful. Now, to be able to do this, you have to come up with interesting ideas. Okay, how do you make sure that bunches of eyes looking at your page will somehow give little pieces of wisdom, which will then get converted into something that's more semantically analyzed than what you could do from syntax? Okay, so the examples of these, they're like basically different types of examples of this. The collaborative knowledge compilation, of course, is one, which is an obvious one, where people actually spend not just a couple of cycles, a lot of time sitting there and writing. The funniest thing this morning, I looked up Alito, right? The guy, Alito's Wikipedia entry. And the entry has already been updated. I woke up very early in the morning, and it's already been updated to show that he has been nominated for Supreme Court. Okay, so it's not like a dead encyclopedia which is updated every 15 years or something. It's been updated pretty much real time. I mean, nobody knew that Alito was nominated until like this morning, and already somebody sat up there and, you know, wrote down a Wikipedia entry. I mean, extended the Wikipedia entry. It's very interesting. So clearly, you know, that's one thing. Collaborative, in general, collaborative filtering. Listen, no, collaborative filtering comes next, I think. Let's see. Collaborative curation is something that we'll be talking about today, which is another example where you would basically hope that people will tell you whether a fact, a so-called fact that you extracted from a pretext, is actually a fact or not. Okay, we'll see an example of that. Collaborative tagging, we've seen examples of that in Foxonomies and Flickr and all that stuff. Okay, now these are just the beginnings. Really, a lot more needs to be done. I mean, it's an incredible opportunity. You know, if you have a popular enough website, you know, and if you can get people to look at it, when they're looking at it, you have access to the best computers in the world, in some sense. And how do you use it? How do you steal the cycle? Okay, I don't know the obvious ideas, but here are some of the examples, and I think the most interesting, just as the previous one, a lot of interesting work would still be done in terms of finding the right balance between what computer does and what the humans do. And then keep shifting it slowly. And as you shift it, you know, there is some sort of a the best trade-off somewhere, and after that, it's diminishing returns. You know, you push, you may not get as much background, as much of a advantages. And then here too, you have some examples, but you know, a lot needs to be done still. And the tricky issues here are, how do you pose the problem such that it can be solved using collaborative computing? Okay, and also, how do you incentivize people into letting you steal their brain cycles? What is it, what's in it for them to actually do something for you? And the best way to make sure that they will go off to another site is to beg them, saying, you know, I really would like you to spend some time with my site. You know, nobody likes that kind of nonsense, so they just go off. So you almost have to do it such that they feel there is an incentive if they spend a couple of extra minutes. Okay. So, by the way, this is a very interesting, these are not just for web, by the way. This is also connected to how a variety of other projects are also taking place. So, for example, there is this classic project, COG. How many of you know? COG is this robotics project at MIT some years back. Okay. And so basically what they wanted was somebody to teach robots, you know, a bunch of things. Let's say, you know, I think in the case of COG, probably it is natural language, okay? And now teaching is a painful activity, okay? I mean, I don't mean to you, but, you know, in general, teaching is, you know, you take, I mean, somebody once pointed out to me, and this is a beautiful point, that we have made our world so incredibly complex that our kids have to go to school for 20 years just to get by in this world. Okay, no animal needs to do this. You know, animals get up and get running. You know, we need you to keep in school for 20 years just to make ends meet. Okay, so there's a lot of incredible amount of background knowledge that somebody has to keep putting into you. And evolutionarily, we, you know, our brains have been messed around with such that we think kids are cute. And so we don't mind spending tons and tons and tons of time telling them the same old thing 28,000 times. While if you guys ask me, you know, after 2-3 times, I may not find it interesting, you know, worth my time. Because presumably the evolution has not made my brain think all of you are cute, whereas most of us think small kids are cute. Okay. So what did the COG project do? Basically, they put for the front end of this robot a little face, not even a real face, actually, a thing which looks like a face, okay, with a bunch of eyebrows and a little nose and a little cute mouth. It actually doesn't look cute at all, but we are desperate to find anything that sort of, you know, we are evolutionally programmed to see anything small and human-looking is cute, okay? So people would sit in front of COG for hours on teaching it. You know, these are well-paid MIT lab folks, and they're wasting their time sitting in front of this robot, teaching it natural language. And while Rodney Brooks, you know, goes somewhere else, you know, the guy who is starting this project. So again, you found a way of incentivizing people's interactions with this robot, okay? And what we did there was we essentially found a short circuit. You depended on the evolution that, you know, evolution has made us, you know, the reason that we find small kids cute is not something that Rodney Brooks did to you. It's just that's already there. So you have to find those sorts of biological imperatives and then find a way of incentivizing what you're doing on the web page, you know, with that. Okay. Obviously, web page isn't going to be as cute as human kids, but you know, we have to do the best we can. And the third thing is, tapping into the collective unconscious. This is also something that I mentioned last time. Again, this happens many of the interesting projects on the web these days wind up having, especially this part is really very much about web, whereas the previous part, incentivizing and getting, you know, stealing people's cycles, that stuff, you know, may or may not be just for web. You know, it can also be, for example, for the COG project, okay? This, on the other hand, is very much about web. You know, when you're looking at web, it's not randomly generated. Okay, it's not randomly generated. So there is a lot of knowledge that people have written in some language or other. So even if you just look at the English web, it's actually, most of the stuff that's written is probably actually true. You know, most of it. And at least it's not gobbledygook. It's not somebody just typing ASDFGH, ASDFGH millions and millions of times and putting up a web page. Okay. Now, knowing that it's in fact web is written by humans, so analyzing its structure and content allows us to tap into the collective unconscious in some sense. You know, it's like a very interesting point. And we actually started talking about it towards the end of last class as to how you could check whether or not a fact about a X being a city, whether or not that's a fact, can be assessed by just in terms of the hits on the web. And that makes sense only because web was made by humans. If it was a random collection of English alphabet pages, not even English pages, English alphabet pages, then you don't expect it to have any hope. You don't expect to get anything out of doing this sort of analysis on that. Okay. So whether Nie is, my student Nie is checking out what is the idiomatic usage of English by asking web, by asking Google, or whether know-it-all folks are checking whether or not a fact is actually a fact by asking Google. It's not Google they are dependent on. It's the fact that web is written by people. Okay. So even if some number of people are out there, they're totally clueless and they're actually writing wrong facts, wrong quote-unquote facts onto the web. Okay. On the overall, in terms of the majorities, it winds up working out in the favor of at least what we consider as the truth. Okay, at least truth by majority, if not truth in an objective sense. Okay, so if web was there in 1400 something, you know, if you asked the fact, does the sun revolve around human being, sun revolve around Earth, you know, it would have given very high confidence to that, except this poor guy Galileo, who would have put up a web page and he would be put in the jail for that. But everybody else will say, yeah, that's exactly what's happening. Okay, so at least our majority view of the truth about this world is available on the web. Okay, by the way, that picture, does anybody guess who that picture is? That's Carl Jung, who actually coined the term collective unconscious, collective subconscious. He's an analytical psychologist. You can go and read about him. But the important point for us really is you could actually get by doing this kind of analysis on the large corpora. Web is one of the large corpora because it's made by humans. Okay. Okay. So for example, examples of this are analyzing term co-occurrences in the web scale corpora to capture semantic information, which is basically what we're going to discuss today. So we are saying if two words appear in the same, you know, sentence are the same sentence close to each other, then they are connected somehow in meaning. This only makes sense because we think everybody writing pages are trying to make some meaning out of those pages. Okay, whereas if you were to generate all pages by another computer picking up, you know, words at random from a bag of words, and so you do bag of words, I mean, this is a very interesting point. You do bag of words retrieval. Suppose web is generating bag of word generation. Do you understand what I'm saying? So here is a case where you're hoping that the generation model is not the model you're actually using for retrieval. Do you understand what I'm saying? Because if in fact the web was generated by picking words randomly, many of these smart ideas such as co-occurrence must mean meaning make no sense. Okay. Okay. Now what else? Analyzing the link structure of the web graph to discover communities. This is something that we discussed, and this is something DOD and NSA are very much interested in finding out, you know, where are all the terrorists, and you know, they're all obviously making links to each other so that we can go and find them. So that's the another one. And finally, analyzing the transaction patterns of the customers and seeing that if two customers are similar in their patterns, then you can fill in the gaps for the other customers. If the transaction patterns were generated randomly, this makes no sense. Okay. Again, these are like meta discussion. I mean, you know, these are not, I can't ask you questions on this on the homework or on the exams, but I think these are some of the important patterns that are emerging in terms of where are all the most exciting projects on the web going. Okay, so you can ask yourself, whenever you read something, see which of these are they trying to do, or write me big idea numbers 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, etc., and then we can talk about it in the end of the semester. By the way, end of the semester, normally we have an interactive review, and you people tell me what happened in the semester, because I have a completely different opinion of what happened in the semester. What matters is what you think, and so maybe you can tell me some more facts about that, some more big ideas. Okay. Any questions on this stuff? Okay. So we are now going to talk a little bit more about the stuff that we were discussing last time, which is basically information extraction. And I sort of said that information extraction can be motivated, this whole information extraction stuff can be motivated from the semantic web point of view, which basically assumes that there is tag data and there is background knowledge about those tags. So data should have tags, and the knowledge, there should be knowledge about what how those tags are related to other tags. So the tagging part is RDF, and the tags being related to each other is RDFS, which is the RDF schema. If you have that, then you can do more interesting inferences. Okay, that's the basic idea. So now, so the question, of course, is one way of that making that happen is everybody sits down and writes pages now. And whenever they're writing a simple page, they will actually tag their pages with, saying whenever they say my name, then they would put teacher begin, teacher end. Presumably to say this guy is a kind of a teacher. Okay. And then hopefully if there is a tag in the hierarchy about teachers and how those teachers are connected to other concepts, then you can do more interesting inferences. Okay, so somebody has to tag the data. And the second is somebody has to have this background knowledge put in. And one way you can do it is let people now onwards be well-behaved and write these stuff, okay, which is basically what semantic web does. The other is to think of trying to actually automate this process, or at least partly automate this process. Okay, by, for example, so there are two projects we will talk about today, two ideas we'll talk about today. One is SemTag and Seeker, which basically takes a page, starts with a background knowledge. Now, background knowledge listed in terms of classes, subclasses, and so on. Takes a new page and tries to look for instances of these concepts in this page. And whenever it finds an instance of each concept in this page, it will put an angle bracket begin, that class, angle bracket end, that class. So it's actually automatically tagging your pages. So if you are lazy, somebody else will tag your page. Okay? This is an automated annotation sort of issue, and we'll see where the status is on this. Okay? The other is, now here actually, as I said, these guys will start with background knowledge. They start with background knowledge, and they're looking for, instances of the concepts in their background knowledge in the current pages. The knowledge extraction, the know-it-all sort of project, as we say, will learn the background knowledge ourselves. Okay? So then you learn the background knowledge, then you use the learned background knowledge to tag it, and you don't need people. We can just get people out of web completely. Okay? So that's the basic idea. Okay? Less facetiously, both of these are useful, because if you expect these to be done by humans, they are pretty time-consuming. Okay, so actually, I will discuss them in the opposite order. I would think actually, automatic annotation is easier than knowledge extraction. Okay, I would say if I have to do one, I would do this first, and then I'll do this. But since we started talking about this last class, I'll complete this discussion about know-it-all and then go back to this. Okay. So let's do the extraction of knowledge from pretext, and we were talking about how to do this for templated text already. And for templated text, extraction is always written as a regular expression, simply, okay? Because you know that there is some sort of a regularity in the text, and so you can always say skip, 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 and skip to a particular landmark, which is either a HTML tag or a particular word. So you skip up to that word and then grab the next couple of words and then put it as the filler for some slot. Okay, so we looked at that last class. So today we'll be looking at what if the text is not templated, it's just written by normal, you know, humans for normal human consumption. Templated text is written for normal human consumption, but not written by humans. So all sentences have the exact same repeated pattern. Okay, whereas if humans write the text also, they tend not to repeat the structure. Okay, and there's no simple structure. Okay, so the just as in the normal text, in the templated text, you can think in terms of regular expressions as the way of unwrapping. Okay, here you can think in terms of, basically you need natural language processing, you need some analysis of the text. The simplest analysis you can do is syntax analysis. Okay, you all know from your grade school or from probably another NLP course more recently, our linguistics course, that you obviously, for whatever any language you start with, there's a grammar. You know, for English, there's a grammar. And you given a sentence, you can do the grammar parse tree. Okay, what's called the part of speech tagging. Now, part of speech does not make semantics. What's interesting is, if you cannot find a part of speech tagging for a sentence, that means it's syntactic gobbledygook. Okay, and you know, there is this beautiful theory about how even small kids know, even before they know anything about meaning, they know about syntax. Okay, so you can tell really small kids sentences which are syntactically incorrect, and they'll give you tough looks to the extent kids can manage tough looks. And if you give them a syntactically correct sentence which is semantically gobbledygook, they will actually try to exercise their brain cells to make meaning out of it. Because what do they know? They think you're the big guy, and you know, if you're sending this sentence, it must have been. Okay. So first syntax, then if it's not even syntactically correct, then you don't even care about the name. So if you have part of speech tagging, then you can write the patterns of extraction in terms of parts of speech. So you can say, look for a noun phrase followed by another noun phrase. If you ever find those, then you know, here is a rule which tells you what to extract from these phrases. Okay, so just as previously the landmarks were HTML tags or specific stop words, okay, here the landmarks are the syntactic structures, the noun phrase or the verb phrase or preposition, something like that. So you now try to write your extraction pattern in terms of this. So to be able to do this, of course, what you need is you need the ability to do part of speech tagging. Okay, in humans sort of barely know it. What's one of the funniest things is we are very good at, if you are a native speaker in any language, you're very good at making only syntactically correct sentences, and oftentimes very bad at analyzing a sentence in terms of its syntactic structure. So most of us don't know what grammar is, but we would know if I tell you a wrong sentence, you'll say, it makes no sense. It's not syntactically correct. But if I give you a sentence and ask you to do me a part of speech tagging, you know, it's not obvious. That's why we have to teach you in the school. Something that's obvious to you, we never teach you in the school. Have you ever wondered why people don't teach you how to speak, normal speaking, whereas we teach you how to write? Because certain things come from evolution, certain things have to be taught. Okay. Anyway, part of speech tagging is, right now we are at a point where NLP, where part of speech tagging is off-the-shelf software. Okay, you can get a part of speech tagger, you know, there are many of them. For example, the papers that you read have, I think, Eric Brill's tagger, which is one of the currently pretty good part of speech tagging software. And it just basically takes any arbitrary, it only works for English. This is all English-centric. Okay, so it takes English sentences and it finds syntactic tree for that. Okay, and so you don't have to run this. I mean, although to understand how Brill's tagger works, you should have known something about grammar of English, and you know what's the best way of parsing. After all, what is part of speech tagging? It's basically parsing. That's what it is. It's parsing. Okay. It's way costlier than normal parsing because computer languages are way more structured than human languages. Okay, so you could do that. And more importantly, actually, there are very complex sentences on which many of these taggers will fail. Okay, but that's okay. In fact, one of the interesting things is the average writing level of an average human being is pretty darn low. It's like, I believe it's like fifth standard writing is what most people can understand, okay? Which is why newspapers are written for people who have been dropped on their heads. You know, they write it, you know, in very simple English, okay? And you try to use GRE vocabulary, you would not have any subscribers for your newspaper, okay? So, while it is true that even tagging is hard for complex sentences, there are enough simple sentences on the web. Just because web is written by human beings like you and me. Okay, it's not written by philosophers. You know, try to read something like Heidegger or something and try to tag those, and then you'll have fun. Okay, but people like you and me will write simple, the dog ate something or other. And you know, those are very easy to tag. And in fact, you actually notice this in the Know It All paper, that they depend on there being large number of simple sentences that can be easily tagged. So they, you know, every once in a while somebody wants to show off and write a run-on sentence or a pretty long, complex sentence. They just forget it. You know, we can still get all the facts from the simple ones. And for everybody who's showing up with a complex sentence, hopefully there are some other people who are writing this in small, small sentences. And so you can get the long knowledge from other places anyway. Okay. So, the background is just as regular expressions make the background for templated text, part of speech tagging makes the background for free-form text, for example, currently. Okay. And then so you write a bunch of rules based on that. So this is what we are looking at. These are called actually, you know, it's been known in language community, linguistics community, that there are these patterns, generic patterns from which you can derive at least, you know, description logic types of sentences, class subclass type of sentences. Okay. By the way, much of what we would be extracting with this sort of things are, for the want of better terms, are best seen as base knowledge. So if you think of first order predicate logic, okay, you have a bunch of universally quantified axioms, and then a bunch of, so for all x and y and z, parent xy and parent y, you know, parent yz implies grandparent xz. That's a universally quantified sentence. There is not very good chance of you learning that by just, you know, doing a bunch of extractions from the web. Okay. However, knowing that parent Rav Soumya, that's a fact. That's just a base level fact. You know, we mentioned this differentiation when we were talking about semantic web, right? Base level facts are ground facts. And then these other ones are basically rules, you know, quantified rules. What we are trying to learn here are bunches and bunches of base level facts. Okay, so single predicate facts or binary predicate facts and things like that. Okay, and then you basically can give this to, the number of rules are hopefully much fewer than the number of base level facts. And so if somebody can sit down and write the number of rules, and then these base level facts are much more voluminous, and then you throw them in and magic happens through inference. Okay. So you could use extraction patterns such as this. In this case, it says cities such as Boston, Los Angeles, and Seattle. And so what that means is Boston is a city, Los Angeles is a city, Seattle is a city. Now this is an approximate pattern because, so what this would say is whenever you have in front of you a syntax tree which says C such as NP1, NP2, and NP3, then essentially the heads of these NP noun phrases belong to this class C. Now this is an easy way to write a bunch of rules. Okay. Now if you do that, and then of course there are exceptions. In fact, as we said, and the idea is, like for example, this one, it says countries such as Garth Brooks. Okay. So Garth Brooks is not a country. Now in fact, the paper actually makes an interesting argument that if you were to have done your syntactic analysis correctly, you would have found that that in fact this does not satisfy these rules. Okay, so the noun phrases followed by noun phrases, that's what they're looking for. And it turns out, not actually, let me see. In fact, there's another sentence in that. This definitely they point out in the paper that it doesn't have the same syntactic structure as the previous sentence. Okay? Even though you may see the word countries and maps, it does not satisfy the same syntactic structure, so the same rule won't be used. Okay? And similarly, I think there's one on the country music where they realize that the word country there is an adjective to the word music, just from the syntax. Syntactic analysis. It has to be an adjective. Okay? And so it won't be used there either. This rule won't be used there either. So even syntax can actually take care of some of the ambiguities that you would see just from the word level. And then there will still be some ambiguities left. And those are ones that they are actually assessing. You know, once they extract facts, then they assess whether or not the facts are correct. Okay? In all extraction methods of this type, you have two issues. One is how do you extract candidate patterns, and two, how do you assess their correctness? Okay. In fact, right after this, I'll talk about another project, and you have to think about how that project differs from this project in terms of how it extracts versus how it assesses correctness. Okay. Now, in the case of Know It All, the assessment essentially is in terms of these kits. This basically in terms of, so they compute probabilities. Mutual information is a probability measure. Conditional probability is a probability measure. Probabilities can be computed in terms of counts. The question is, who is going to give me counts? They're saying hits can be converted into counts. So to say, I want sentences which has both Seattle and city, you ask the search engine for the number of hits for Seattle plus city. And you want the number of counts just for the Seattle, it says hit for Seattle. And this number by this number essentially is probability of A and B divided by probability of A. Okay. So the important thing is that probabilities are now being estimated based on the hits on the entire web. Okay. So the number that they care about is the number that comes on the top. When, you know, which most of you don't even look at. When you ask Google for a query, you're only looking at the answers. But in the first line, it says, you know, first 10 of approximately 10,575 pages. And that's the number that we are looking for. Okay? Okay. So basically, if you to connect this up to what we already learned in the classification learning, remember we did mutual information and naive Bayes classifier the last time. When did we do it? We did it in the context of what application? First of all, we did it in terms of supervised classification, supervised learning. But we did it, for example, in the context of spam mail classification. And there were two pieces for the spam mail approach that we looked at. There were two pieces that we had to deal with. One is feature selection, which is what words are actual reasonable features. And the other is using those features, deciding the class. And you used mutual information for feature selection, if you remember. And you used naive Bayes classifier for having selected the features, how to combine them. How to combine the probabilities of those features given the class and invert them to class given these features. That's all we do here too. Okay. So they use mutual information to figure out what are the right features to even care about. Okay. What are the right features to care about? And then, so for example, if you're trying to figure out whether or not Seattle is a city, okay, then you would expect that if Seattle is a city, then you would expect that there would be sentences such as, in the city of Seattle, somewhere. So you can ask, and since you expect that, then you would say Seattle plus city to figure out how many times Seattle is occurring with the word city versus how many times is it occurring without the word city. Okay. And you also expect, if Seattle is a city, then you might also expect something like the concert hall in Seattle. Okay, because normally concert halls are there in you know, maybe many a time there in cities, okay, or the corporation of Seattle, or the waterfront in Seattle. You expect all these things if Seattle is a city. Of course, you know, waterfront, you don't expect for all cities because not all cities have waterfront. Okay. Now, so each of these will increase your confidence that Seattle is in fact a city. So think of Seattle as flu, which is your disease. And it causes words such as city, words such as concert halls, words such as football teams. Okay. And so, given these, you can tell whether or not you have the city. That's exactly what we did in, you know, naive Bayes classification. Given the symptoms, we tried to figure out what is the probability of disease. Okay, so what we are trying to do here is using the mutual information, you are even trying to figure out which of these many symptoms are even reasonable symptoms to consider. So for example, hopefully waterfront, which I did, you know, Seattle is a city, maybe it will have waterfront in Seattle, but maybe that's not a very important feature. Maybe certain other features are more important. So what you're going to look at in this case is look at the right features, you know, take the top K features in terms of the mutual information. And then for those features, you compute the conditional probabilities, again using hits, and then use naive-Bayes classification. Naive Bayes technique to assess the probability that Seattle is a city given that all these things are there. Okay, and now what actually, in fact, in the paper, so this is your NBC, Naive Bayes classification, this is the way in NBC you actually compute the joint probabilities by assuming that all features are independent of each other given the class. So that's why you are saying, given the class phi, fi is independent. So this is the multiplication. Given the class phi, fi is independent of fj. So you just multiply this. Okay. So the one point that they make in the paper, that's sort of interesting, is to point out that you are not just interested in normal classification tasks. You are trying to say either you have the disease or you don't have the disease. Okay. Here actually what you're looking for is all the cities. So it's, in essence, what you're looking for is the actual probability itself. If the probability is high, then it's likely to be a city. If not, it's not. Okay. So what they do is, so this is probability that Seattle is a city given that there are these many, given that there are sentences saying city of Seattle, sentences saying corporation of Seattle, sentences saying sports teams of Seattle. Okay, and so you computed this number. Now, according to this, of course, there may also be a number for avocado is a city. There may also be a number for, you know, rock and roll is a city, because we built this city based on rock and roll, all that stuff. And so, you know, you do, you know, bag of words analysis, you have rock and roll and city in the same sentence. And Google isn't really doing any semantic analysis. We know that. Okay, so we have to make sure that rock and roll is still not a city and Seattle is still a city. And what you do is you look at all these probabilities and you put a threshold. And you say anything whose cityness is more than this threshold is a real city. If not, it's not a city. And if you make that threshold too loose, you get a lot more cities, high recall, lot less correct cities, low precision. Okay, if you make it very high, you get a couple of cities, but whatever you get are cities. So you can trade precision versus recall in terms of the facts that you are gathering. Again, that's something that they discuss in the paper. Okay. So it's kind of nice here that the same technique that you learned, which is feature selection and naive-based classification to do spam analysis, is also used for knowledge extraction. Whoever thought that spam classification is directly connected to knowledge extraction? I mean, if you did, then you clearly are way ahead of me. Okay. Okay. So here are some numbers actually that they show, and I thought it was interesting to see. Well, let's see. So if you are trying to look for Yakima and city, then you're looking for what is the feature informativeness the point-wise mutual information of Yakima being a city, and that's 0.02. Okay? Now you say, wow, 0.02, that doesn't look like it's particularly large number to select Yakima. I mean, so basically you're trying to see whether or not you should be checking city nets for Yakima. Okay, this is only 0.02. But if you look for avocado and city, it's much less than 0.02. So when you put a threshold, you better put a threshold. You know, again, this is actually something that people may not recognize. You know, a lot of speech recognition is done using probabilistic methods. Okay, so you guys, how many of you have used computer speech recognition? You try to say, computer, do this, and it does something else, right? Okay, so how does those things work, especially the isolated work speech recognition? How does it work? It basically computes, given the signal that it got from you, the probability that what you said is this word. Okay, so in this case, disease is the word, symptom is the signal. Okay, now it's trying to compute the probability of various words given the signal that it actually reached. It's oftentimes, I don't know whether you think about it this way or not, but many people who hear about speech recognition for the first time think that computer would probably have 0.8 for the obvious answer, and everything else would be, you know, all other words will have much less than 0.8. You know, obviously everything else adds up to 0.2. The reality is they're all really, really small. Okay, how many words do you have? Maybe you'll have, if you have a functional vocabulary of 10,000 words, then you're talking about 1 over 10,000 is the uniform probability. And which is a very small number for each. All you're looking for is who is little above that and who is much below this. Okay, that's why in fact it's very important to do log, because your floating points will start having so many leading zeros that everything will become zeros when you're doing these kinds of analysis. Okay? So, I mean, you have to understand for a particular word to become more the most probable word that you spoke, all it needs to be is that it is the one thing that's more than the, you know, more than all other guys' probabilities. And now you know that if all of them are equal to, you know, 1 over 10,000, then they're all uniformly equal. So now you take a little fraction of 1 over 10,000, add it to one of these guys, and subtract 1 over 9,900 fraction of this from everybody else. Then suddenly this guy is a winner. And believe me, in fact, when you look at speech recognition techniques, the internals of them, the probabilities they assess, they are not like, wow, the winner is winning by a huge margin. It's more like the 2000 election rather than, you know, a landslide. Okay, so anyway, that's the number here. So based on this, he realizes that the mutual information between avocado and city is much less than the mutual information between Yakima and the city, just because of the heat. Okay. There are some neat things that actually they talk about. Let me just say this. One of the interesting things is, so as far as I'm concerned, this particular work is really like starting to try and show that some of these things can be done. Okay, and after you pick up all the obvious facts, there are all sorts of problems that you'll get into. Okay, so hopefully they would change the project and do something else. But still, it's a good start. And, you know, the second guy always has to deal with a harder problem than the first guy. You know, and if you're a first guy, then you get to give the simplest solution. And you get lots of points for actually thinking that it's doable. Okay. Anyway, so here is a scenario where actually there's an interesting, there are some problems that these guys talk about in this, all sorts of problems, one of which is there will be multiple word senses. Sometimes a word might have multiple senses. Chicago is both a city and a movie. Okay. Now, whenever that happens, since Chicago, the city, has many more hits than Chicago, the movie, you know, if you're not careful, you'll never realize that Chicago can be a movie. So you won't capture that fact from the web. Okay. So what they're actually doing is, what you could do is you could unmask. What you basically wind up doing is, as long as the dominant meaning is there, the other guy will never stand up. So having figured out the dominant meaning, then you get the dominant meaning out by saying, look for Chicago minus city. By the way, this is almost similar to the way you would compute the second and the third eigenvector. The first eigenvector would always be the one that power iteration will get you to. Now, if you want to get the second eigenvector of a matrix, what do? You do deflation, which is essentially remove the first eigenvector from the matrix, and then compute the first eigenvector of the new matrix. And since the big brother is gone, the second guy stands. Okay? So more or less, that's what we are doing. So in this case, actually, to compute the movie sense, essentially, they would wind up doing Chicago plus movie minus city by Chicago minus city. Chicago minus city is the baseline. Okay? Non-city references to Chicago, and what fraction of them are to the movie. And if you get a number there, and if that number is reasonable, then you can use that. Now you can start saying, well, Chicago is probably a movie. Let me now assess the probability that Chicago is a movie. And so you consider all other possible symptoms of a movie, which is the director of Chicago is. There may be something called director of Chicago is. So you look for director of for Chicago. And all these are extra probabilities, and you throw them all in, and you do your NBC, you'll compute the probability that Chicago is a movie now. So if you didn't do it, you wouldn't even have been looking to check whether Chicago can ever be a movie. So this is basically even recognizing that it's worth checking for Chicago being a movie. Okay. So there's some nice numbers here, which basically show that with the unmasking, you are able to actually capture the secondary meaning. Without unmasking, they'll just get dominated by the primary meaning. Not surprising. Again, I think, in fact, one of the interesting things about this paper, which is probably what makes it easy to teach from, is the ideas are quite simple. Okay, I mean, what's hard about that particular paper? How many of you actually read this paper? Wow, truth, suddenly. I should record this, I guess. So, I should read it. I understand today is a project, but I'm probably desperately looking for excuses for you rather than you looking for excuses for yourself. You really should read. When I say read, you should read. But if you read, you would find that not a single part of the paper is particularly hard to understand. Of course, it wouldn't be any hard to understand now that I actually explained it to you too, but even if you read it, it wouldn't be hard to understand. And it'll be worth doing it because it'll give you confidence. You know, it just came last year. And if you can read a paper that just got published last year and was a runner-up for the best paper award in the World Wide Web Conference, then you can go and tell people, look, you know, I know what is the game you guys are playing. I can do it too. Okay? I mean, if you don't understand it, of course, you know, I'm not sure how many of you understand the superstring theory and how many of you can pick up a paper and understand the superstring theory. Okay? But we are not talking about superstring theory here. You know, it's a nice problem, but it's easy actually to understand given your background. Okay, now I want to give a plug to CBIOC, which I mentioned last time, which is essentially this project that's in the nascent stages. In Chittabaral is leading it. It's actually in ASU. And what they are doing is essentially to do extraction from text, except not at the web scale, but at sub-web scale. So they're looking at web of biologists. And they're looking for picking facts from the biological paper abstract. Okay? Why, as I said last time, biology is a highly descriptive science, and there are tons and tons of papers being written about yet another protein, yet another gene, yet another connect interaction, and so on. And somebody does a experiment, finds out the, finds out that there is reason to believe that these things are interacting, so writes a paper. And this is very useful because nobody even knows. So for example, imagine writing a paper saying, based on my experiments, I think Chicago probably is a movie. So write a paper on that. Nobody accepts it, because everybody else knows that Chicago is a movie. Whereas if you say, based on my experiment, I believe that protein XYZ would be involved in the interaction between gene 2055 and some other gene. That's useful to the extent nobody else knows it. Right? So the base knowledge is not there yet. I mean, we just barely decoded the genome. I mean, for those of you who are keeping track of anything other than computer science. Okay, and so we have a lot of base knowledge that needs to be actually, you know, discovered by people. And so every little base knowledge that people discover, so there is no collective unconscious in biology. The collective unconscious in biology is the union of biology papers, and it's very painful to read them, even for biologists, you know, all of them. Okay, so the question is whether there is a way, so the way normally it's done is people go to PubMed, look, do keyword search almost on papers, get abstracts, look at the abstract, decide whether or not they should read this to help them in their research, and if so, read them. Okay. Now, you read papers too, but most of the time you're reading papers not to get just the base level facts, but because probably you want to get algorithms. Here we are actually talking about, let me read this paper to figure out whether Chicago is a movie or not. I mean, if you want a metaphor. Okay, that's the level at which we are talking about. It's a descriptive field, and it's for good reason, that information is very important because nobody knows it, so it's important. Now, the question is there a faster way than everybody reading these papers? And so the idea that Chitta and Co. are trying out is essentially analyze the abstract, okay, look for patterns of the same type that you looked previously, instead of saying Seattle, cities such as Seattle means Seattle is a city. Now you say the X interacts Y, if you have a pattern of a sentence saying X interacts Y, then obviously there is an interaction between X and Y. So this is the simplest thing, but there are more interesting patterns that they're looking for on the abstract. Okay? Now most of them actually they're interested in binary, at least binary level predicates. You know, saying X is a gene, not very useful. But knowing that certain things interact with each other, are, you know, this particular gene plays a role in this particular protein. That sort of things are important. Okay, so the question is, how do they do it? You are involved, right? Taufik is involved, for example, in this project. And I think their group, Hassan's group, essentially applies pretty much a off-the-shelf tagger, you know, part of speech tagger to the abstract. Okay. I don't know whether do you use Brill tagger or you use this constrained grammar tagger thing? LTI. Yeah, that's the constrained grammar tagger. Okay, so there are different taggers and they're using one of them. And then they get the syntactic structure of the sentence in the abstract. From there, they are capturing the interaction. Let's say, you know, X interacts with Y or X is related to Y, this sort of stuff. Okay? Up to this point, it sounds very similar to know-it-all, except know-it-all tries to know-it-all for the entire web, whereas these guys are trying to know it just for biology. Okay? CBioC is for know-it for biology. Now comes the interesting issue, which is, after you extract a pattern, in the case of know-it-all, you could assess whether or not that fact is correct by just Hitch analysis. Can you do that here? Can you say, is it true? So how many pages in the world or how many papers are saying gene 1 interacts with gene 2? Well, for crying out loud, the only reason this paper got published is because he's the only guy who said it first. The second guy who says it won't get his paper published, his or her paper published. So Hitch analysis is not going to work. So how do you actually know that? So first of all, there are two different issues. When I talk about factness, there are two different issues. In fact, this is something that was also true previously. Your extraction itself could be wrong. So for example, remember Google Scholar extracted that LBAC and T-Stock are authors. Now you may not know much about anything, but you may know that LBAC and T-Stock doesn't look like authors. Especially if, in fact, L is looking back and taking stock. These are the first and last names of two authors. Most people can see that makes no sense. So the extraction itself is syntactically wrong. Like Gartbrooks is a country. Okay? Some of these things are number 5 is a country. No, it's not Gartbrooks. Number 5 is a country. Okay? Now, those are syntactically wrong extractions. The second is, it's a syntactically correct extraction, but it may be semantically wrong. In the case of know-it-all, you do both. at the same time by looking for hits on the world. Okay, so neither would there be five is a city sentences, nor would there be Garth Brooks is a city sentences on the web. So you can assess whether or not these are correct syntactically as well as semantically just by looking at the web. Now in the case of biology, you need both still. So you need to know whether it is syntactically correct. Did these guys, part of speech tagger, actually screw up and say that gene 1 interacts with and some other author's name, because that author's name was present in that sentence? How do you know that they, you know, did not do that? The second, of course, is if they actually syntactically correctly extracted the fact, is it semantically correct? Is there reasons to believe that this is actually universally true? Now, the second issue, you guys can clearly see, is a hard issue, because if, you know, the way, the only reason to believe it is it got published in a paper that is indexed in PubMed. So it must be true because somebody thought the experiments are reasonable, so let's publish this paper. Of course, lots of experiments were reasonable at one time and later on were found to be wrong, and so in fact this could be wrong knowledge. Okay, so in terms of this biological knowledge, I can never really tell you, I mean nobody can really tell you upfront whether or not what this paper is saying is actually true. What people can tell you is whether or not your tagger has actually extracted things that biologists reading the same abstract would have extracted. So biologists reading this abstract would have said, yeah, gene 1 interacts with gene 2. So that's what, according to this paper, so they'll remember this. Now, if you do that, then you have made biologists' life easy. If you said gene 1 interacts with Hassan Dawalchu, then you didn't make their life easy, because Hassan Dawalchu is not a gene. Okay, but it's not obvious to your tagger. Okay, so what these guys are doing is they bring in, so there is this issue of you need people to tell you whether extraction is right. Okay, so now this is now becoming collaborative computation. Okay, so how can I, people know, people can read the abstract and tell whether or not it is a fact from the abstract. Okay, so the issue is the following. If some people are, you know, voting on the extracted facts, saying yes, they are actually correctly extracted. We are not talking about their objective accuracy, but whether they are correctly extracted. And so, you know, if you allow people to vote on this, then after some number of votes, you can say, yeah, it looks like it's a fact that's correctly extracted. It may not be objectively correct to the extent this paper itself is bogus paper, but at least it's not Taufik Sagar that's making a mistake. Okay? It's a useful thing to do. So what they're trying to do is, of course, how do you get people to vote on this? And there are a couple of useful things. First of all, biologists are geeks, you know, so they have anyway spending time reading papers, so you can ask them to help, you know, humankind, and they'll spend a couple of extra seconds. And secondly, you can catch them at the right moment where they are willing to spend time. So the idea they have is when somebody is looking, I mean, I can't see it. I don't think you can see it here, but there may be some other place where I have that. When somebody is looking at, when somebody is looking at a paper on the PubMed, they basically open a little window next to it. And if this paper has already been tagged previously, I mean, has extracted, you know, facts have been extracted from this paper previously, then you can show to the user, the reader, these are the facts. Do you think these are actually correct extractions? And to the extent they vote, you have information about somebody who knows English and can convert English sentences to predicate facts. Okay? And once you have this, then it becomes, at least, you know, if you have a bunch of these kinds of facts, then in essence you have a database. You have a database of these kinds of facts. Entity interacts with entity 2, it's a table, and then for each of these tuples, you know how many, you know, you get to vote on this, for example, and you know for each of these tuples, you know how many negative votes are there, how many positive votes are there, and you know, you have a chance of figuring out whether extractions are reasonable. And then, of course, you can combine this with other manually curated databases on the web about biology and do inferences on the entire data. This is the general picture. of this collaborative bioseparation. Both of, so the important thing I want you to understand is both of them are information extraction ideas. One is for the entire web, the other is for biology. And just that changes some crucial details about how things work. Because for the entire web, if it's a knowledge that everybody knows except you are the only silly guy in the room, that's you, the computer, are the only silly guy in the room, then you can do hits analysis to figure out what is the right, whether or not it's right. If it's knowledge that only one biologist out of a million knows, and they wrote it in the paper, then you need something more like this. But the one part of it is same, this idea of doing part of speech tagging on the sentences and writing, you know, hyponym-based patterns, saying this city, X, and a city of something means this is a city. X interacts with Y means Y interacts with X is a predicate. Now, interact may not actually appear exactly that way. There may be variations of that word. Presumably, they have a bunch of these kinds of patterns that they're extracting over. Okay? So the main difference between KnowItAll and CBioC is assessment. In one case, the assessment is just on the web because everybody else other than you knows it. In the other case, you are assessing using humans. Okay, now, in fact, there was an interesting issue. These votes, as I said, you need to differentiate between am I voting for the objective correctness of the fact or am I voting for whether or not the program did the right thing. Okay? We are mostly looking for whether the program did the right thing. But if people are ready to tell us that, you know, this guy, he has written 15 papers already and they're all bogus, so there's no real reason to believe this other paper. Apparently this guy, poor guy from MIT just got thrown out yesterday because he was making, you know, large number of great facts up. Making facts up is much easier than actually, you know, testing them in the wet lab. Painful. Wet lab is wet to begin with, if you notice that. Okay, so making it up is much easier. So this guy made up and somebody caught up with him and now he's thrown out. Okay. So if the humans know this, or, you know, this is the 15th tier conference, nobody actually goes to this conference. You know, papers just go there and, you know, nobody is really listening. So probably the stuff that is there, nobody really refereed it. So there's no reason to believe it. If you want to give these kinds of information, that's a separate type of vote. You can actually have vote on the correctness of the extraction as well as a vote on the whether or not this is objectively true fact. We don't expect most people know the second part, unless in, you know, obvious cases where there is bogus involved. But at least this much you can tell. Okay? So this is actually a project in that's going on right now. And so if you are interested, go talk to Chitta, go talk to Taufik, and all sorts of neat stuff is going on there. So the third part for today's class, which I will probably start and complete next class, is, as I said long, long back when we started, we want to extract, to the extent you want to support semantic web dream, there are two parts to it. One is you want to extract base knowledge, I mean extract facts directly. The other is if you have background information, tag the files with these facts. Okay. Now, I understand that these are sort of connected. The closest you could say is, in essence, one is really base level facts. The other could be in theory, extracting knowledge could extract actually quantified axioms too. Although you have noticed that KnowItAll really only extracts base level facts such as Seattle is a city. Okay, I would tell you some project, at least one of the interesting projects in this region, which is annotating existing web pages using some background knowledge, using a specific body of background knowledge that you started with. It's a useful thing. In fact, some of the techniques are similar. And part of the reason I'm telling you this again is our old friend, TF-IDF-based vector similarity would wind up being useful. And this is SemTag and Seeker, the second paper. Okay, that's also there. So let me tell you how this works out. And again, you can, when we are looking at this, you should, in the back of your head, think of how is this different from KnowItAll CBioC, first of all. Now, I can tell you that these are different because this is part one, this is part two, but you need to know whether they're different or not. Okay. And the second issue is what was my second issue? I forgot my second issue. At least you should know how whether it is different from C by OC and know it all. Okay, these annotations. And the second, I guess, is to tell what is it, you know, of the three big ideas that we had in the front, in the beginning of the class, which of the big ideas is this exploiting? In fact, you can ask this from now onwards for anything I tell you, which of these big ideas, if any, is being exploited? You know, what was Noital exploiting? What was CBIOC exploiting? It doesn't have to be just a single idea. The Noital and CBIOC are exploiting actually two different ones. Okay. Anyway, so here is the basic idea of annotation. If you have a piece of text like this, the Chicago Bulls announced yesterday that Michael Jordan will, something. What I want, what semantic web folks hope people would do is actually write sentences, you know, files like this. So basically the, and then resource, reference, blah, 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 basketball team Bulls, Chicago Bulls, okay? And then announced yesterday that resource from blah, 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 athlete Jordan Michael, and then his name on end. So this is the print method. Do you guys, how many of you know Lisp? I mean, I'm sure this is there in other places too. You know Lisp? Java, I'm also, whenever you have an object, you need to print the object. The printing of the object is basically a projection of that object onto the plain paper so that some people who think they only understand that can understand it. So this is the object. And this is the print method for it. If you say Michael Jordan, people remember that. All the other people think this is what you're talking about. But the programs don't think that this is what you're talking about. Because programs only see this string. So this stuff is being put such that other programs analyzing this page will realize that really this is the print of this object, this resource. And this is the print of this resource. This is what RDF wants you to do. And this is what Semantic Web wants you to do. So this is an RDF annotated page. And now if you have RDFs, which basically explains all the fun stuff about, you know, how basketball is a sport and how various sports are connected to each other and all that stuff, then you can start making interesting inferences, such as the thing that you very quickly made last class when I said Magellan went around the world three times and on one he died. And which one did he die? And you knew exactly what was the right answer. That's because you had all this background knowledge sitting right there. And the moment I said Magellan, you connected Magellan to an explorer. And then you connected going around to a travel. And then you use your background knowledge that you can't travel after your death. Okay? Anyway, so this is what we need to do. So the question is, who's likely to do this while typing? Any of you? We barely actually get ourselves to type this. And you know, most people use all sorts of shortenings of this rather than actually lengthening of this. Okay? So the question is, can you do this automatically? Can you somehow see that Chicago Bulls is a sports team? Now, what's interesting is you may have known that Chicago Bulls is a sports team because of your background knowledge. Okay? And so you read this text and you say, wow, this is actually an instance of what I know in the background knowledge. So I make a link from my object corresponding to that to the print representation of that. And that's RDF in some sense. Okay? So this is automated annotation. So this is basically the picture that you are doing in automated annotation. You have a you have a file and you're annotating each piece here by connecting up to your background knowledge. The background knowledge here looks like some sort of a connected set of concepts. So you can think of this as predicate knowledge database. You can think of it as ontologies, which is just a particular subclass of first order predicate logic. But really what you're saying is there are objects in your world and there are print instances of them here and you know you connect them up. The moment you connect it up, it's really you have given RDF description of your paper. So the question is, can I do it automatically? So it's no longer the case that nobody knows that Chicago Bulls is a sports team. In fact, the tagger, the automated annotator knows that Chicago Bulls is a sports team. And when it has a new page, it sees an instance Chicago Bulls, it needs to tell whether or not that is actually the print representation that's actually a print representation of the object. Now, why do I say this? Why can't it be that whenever I see the word Chicago and the word Bulls next to each other, it would just have to be Chicago Bulls, the sports team? Yesterday in Chicago, Bulls ran wild through the streets. Now, of course, it's very hard to make this sentence, I guess, because the only guys who run wild in Chicago are probably Bulls, the sports team. But, you know, if you thought of it in terms of, let's say, what is it, Pamplona, the Spanish city, suppose it has Bulls, the sports team, and Bulls, the Bulls, which actually run around on the street. Okay, the Pamplona Bulls can actually mean either the sports team or the actual Bulls, which run through these narrow streets, running over willing participants during every year, right? So the question is, which is the one? So there is ambiguity even here. Even though you have the string, this string might have been occurring as a projection of object one or object two or object three. And if so, which object is it actually talking about? That's what Semtag and Seeker tries to figure that out. And basically what it figures out is that it says, if you are talking about Chicago Bulls, the sports team, then the 10 sentence, 10 words before, 10 words after would have a certain similarity to a particular set of words. Okay? So they take a TF-IDF of Chicago Bulls, first 10 and last 10, next 10 words, to the region that you expect for Chicago Bulls, the sports team, the region you expect for Chicago Bulls, the Bulls running on the roads. And whichever has the higher TF-IDF, you say that's the one that I actually think is. Okay? You'll go and read the paper and we'll talk more about it next class. And one other interesting thing that you'll realize while reading this is, notice that if I tag somebody else's page, I don't get to write on their page. Right? It's somebody else's page. So where do I put these annotations? So you have something called annotation service, okay, where you store all the annotated versions of pages. And that's what these guys do. So for every page they have annotated, they have a copy of the annotated page in this database. And so if you ever go to page K, then you go to this broker and say, by the way, did you ever annotate page K? And if they did, they say, yeah, we did. Here is your annotation. That's good enough, because everything is on the web. Okay, let's go look at that, and I would basically complete this and go into information integration, which is the next major topic, next class. Yeah. Help yourself for more Raspberry Bots if you feel like.